You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week of August 7, and it's podcast number 52. I'm Joe Elia. This week, we talk with two of the authors of a JAMA study that seems to show that screening women for intimate partner violence in healthcare settings doesn't lead to lessened violence or increased quality of life. The briefest of looks at the other clinical news of the week first. More details are at podcasts.jwatch.org. Two trials in the New England Journal of Medicine find that vertebroplasty, in the words of one commentator, should be viewed skeptically. Next, in late pregnancy, women with mild hypertension seem to benefit from the induction of labor, according to a Lancet study. Finally, the FDA is insisting on a boxed warning for tumor necrosis factor blockers because of their association with cancer in young people on the drugs. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. In its August 5th issue, JAMA presents the results of a trial in which about 7,000 women attending primary care clinics in Ontario, Canada, were screened for intimate partner violence. All participants received information on how to contact social services agencies, but about half had their screenings done before their clinical encounter, and half were screened just after it. The authors were trying to discern whether such information helps. During follow-up interviews over the next 18 months, there was no significant difference between the two groups in the level of recurrent violence. Both the screened before encounter and the screened after encounter groups, if they screened positive at the index visit, had about a 50% chance of suffering abuse over the follow-up period. And by the way, the prevalence of abuse found at the index visit was about 13%. Doctors Harriet McMillan and Nadine Wathan, respectively the first and second authors on the study, have kindly agreed to talk with us about their work. Dr. McMillan, a member of the Offord Center for Child Studies, is a psychiatrist and pediatrician conducting research on the epidemiology of violence against children and women. She is a professor in the departments of psychiatry and behavioral neurosciences and pediatrics at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Dr. Wathan is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Information and Media Studies at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario. Her research is in the area of women's health, especially violence against women and children. Thank you both for your time today.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Joe.
Dr. McMillan, as you note in the paper, various organizations recommend that women be screened for intimate partner violence, but there's no evidence that screening helps. Do you think that those recommendations will now change because of your research?
That's a good question, Joe. I'll be interested to see what happens in that regard. Certainly, I hope that this study will ensure that no further universal screening is implemented or promoted unless further research down the road has different findings. And although Nadine and I want to emphasize that this is one study, we do feel that its findings are valid, and in fact, we do hope that it will lead to organizations rethinking their promotion of universal screening. But so much depends on a range of factors, including political issues. Wouldn't you say, Nadine?
Yeah, I would completely agree, Harriet. And I think I would add that one thing that people should not take from this study is that we should not be asking about abuse in healthcare settings. I think it's extremely important for your listeners to understand that, understanding women's exposure to violence is a very important part of providing good clinical care. And we're in no way saying that clinicians should not be aware and attuned to the issue of violence.
That's clear in the article. What you do say in the article, though, is that you had to screen something like, if you screened 100 women, 87 had no experience or had no recent experience within the past year of intimate partner violence. And so you were able to discern 13. The people, there was a large dropout rate in the study. There was about 40% or so were lost to follow-up. And there was a lot of repeat, no matter whether the clinician, I'm not sure that you gave these numbers, but whether the clinician, even knowing that his or her patient had been subject to intimate partner violence over the past year, only somewhat less than half of those clinicians discussed that with their patients, with those results in hand. That says something about, if we know about the presence of those things, as clinicians, we're not acting on them very, very, very well. That's my editorial comment, and that's not for you to agree or disagree. But it seems to me that if fewer than half of the physicians are talking about the violence with those results in hand, then they should maybe be paying more attention to it.
Well, period here, Joe, and I think you raise an important issue. Part of this, we think, relates to the availability of evidence-based interventions or programs to which women can be referred once violence is identified. So if we compare violence to, say, depression, in fact, many people, including the U.S. Task Force, are recommending screening for depression, but part of that is because once screening for depression occurs and depression is identified, there are effective interventions to which people can be referred. In the case of violence, one of the concerns is once you identify it, then what do you do? Now, there are several good resources out there offering opinions about what to do, but in fact, the question, do we have an effective intervention to which women can be referred once identified? The answer is, at this point, we just don't know. We may have them out there, but they haven't yet been evaluated. So we think, we meaning our particular research group who carried out this work, think that that's a huge issue.
Yes, and the editorialist who writes about your research talks about three general categories of intervention. One is social services. The other is perinatal visits to assess what's going on. And the third is drug counseling for drug and alcohol abuse. Are any of those among the things that you would put at the top of your list?
First of all, there is information indicating that home visitation, other kinds of perinatal supports can benefit women and their newborns in a number of ways. And the best evidence for effectiveness of a home visitation program in the area of violence comes from the Nurse Family Partnership developed by David Olds, who's at the University of Colorado. Now, interestingly, Nadine, myself, and others in our research group thought the evidence for this program was so compelling in reducing child maltreatment and has such benefits for women and children in other domains that we're actually carrying out a study right now with colleagues at West Virginia University, the University of Colorado, including David Olds, Ohio State University, McMaster University, and the University of Western Ontario, to determine if actually developing a particular intervention for intimate partner violence that can be embedded in that home visitation program, if indeed it does reduce partner violence.
Hmm.
So we believe that that's an important area to investigate. We can't say at this point that there's evidence of its effectiveness. That's something we're studying, but we're optimistic that that's an important area to investigate.
I see.
Now, one of the other interventions you asked about was the whole area of social supports, and Nadine has done a lot of work looking at that in a systematic review a few years ago.
Right. So I'll just jump in here. You know, what Harriet's described in terms of nurse home visits is a very targeted type of program where we're really identifying a group at higher risk and then implementing this fairly lengthy and resource-intensive intervention with that group. In terms of what's normally provided to women, I would say at a community level, so the sorts of women, for example, who are coming into the emergency departments in our study or the family practices, what we're talking about is linking these women to existing services in the community. So whether it's other health services in terms of following up for their mental and physical health issues, or shelter services, or housing support, those sorts of things. This is the usual model that we find in the sort of broader community. And really, I guess I would sort of summarize a recent systematic review that was done in the United Kingdom that looked at what sorts of interventions might be helping women in this broader community context. And building on work that's been done looking at advocacy and system navigation and how you can link women to those who can help them move through the system. So if you can imagine the complexity of the systems that women encounter, so you've got a woman who's perhaps just disclosed abuse for the first time, she's in this troubling and violent situation where she might also be suffering from things like depression, which we know is highly comorbid with exposure to violence, and now she's got to navigate these systems, whether it's finding a new school for the kids, getting housing, all these sorts of things. And really what recent evidence has shown is that this idea of system navigation or providing advocacy to help women link with services looks like it might be the way to go. Mm-hmm. So we're actually looking at this in a study that has led here in southwestern Ontario to understand how shelter services are linking women, whether or not they actually come and live in the shelter, what sorts of outreach help women do this. And I think this is quite consistent with the way the evidence is going in terms of broader community services.
There was one comment in the editorial about women who had spent even one night in a shelter seemed to have a lower rate of future abuse.
Right, and that was a study, a series of studies done by Chris Sullivan in Michigan, where they linked women after they'd left a shelter with an advocate. In this case, I believe it was a graduate student who understood the broader system in terms of the services available to women and helped women navigate. And it did show good outcomes. A two-year follow-up, I believe, showed reduced violence for women receiving the intervention. At 3 years, the violence outcomes had sort of leveled out and weren't different between groups, but the life quality benefits persisted for women who'd received that intervention.
So
we just don't also want to leave out the third type of intervention mentioned in that editorial, and that is the area of substance abuse treatment. My understanding from what the two authors, Dr. Morocco and Dr. Cole, are saying is that since we know that addiction may increase a woman's vulnerability to intimate partner violence and increase her dependence on an abusive partner, that it would be important in existing substance abuse programs that are undergoing evaluation to look for, to measure intimate partner violence and to consider the possibility that these types of interventions may reduce intimate partner violence. Again, we don't know that at this point, but that would be an important consideration. I mean, the authors do point out that the relationship between intimate partner violence and substance abuse is complex and needs more study, but I think the fact that they're highlighting this as an area for future research is important.
I think that both clinicians and policymakers will sit up and take notice of your work, and I'm wondering if you could give them some advice as to what to do next week when they go into work. What if first of all a clinician seeing a woman who's screened positive or has revealed that she's in an abusive situation, what might they do differently next week?
Let me just start, it's Harriet here, by saying that they're a group of researchers who work together in the UK and Australia who did a really nice clinical review that appeared in the British Medical Journal, August 9th, 2008, volume 337. And the title is Violence Between Intimate Partners, Working with the Whole Family. And it's by Kelsey Haggerty, and Angela Taft from Australia, as well as Jean Fader from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And they have really well-written sections that talk about the initial response of clinicians, possible questions to ask patients when somebody does disclose, what they refer to as possible validation statements. And personally, I think it's a really excellent resource for those of your listeners who are encountering patients who have been exposed to violence. And almost anybody who's seeing patients is going to encounter someone who's been exposed to violence at some time, and we know that it's much more common than is currently being recognized. So if I were just to give you a quick summary of the kinds of things that I would suggest they think about, first of all, if intimate partner violence is suspected, then it's important to ask family members about it. But one has to take into account issues like privacy. For example, in asking a woman or a man or a child, for that matter, they really need to be asked privately, because there are risks if another family member overhears this.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's important for the clinician to check on the adult or child safety, because we have to remember that we are now recognizing that children being exposed to intimate partner violence in the home, that can lead to the same types of impairment that we're seeing with other types of child maltreatment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would be important to make a safety plan. In terms of responding, that really needs to be in a non-judgmental way and offering ongoing support. And then the clinician needs to consider whether he or she has the experience and expertise to, in fact, do counseling themselves, or if they want to refer the person to advocacy and or therapeutic programs. And our research focused on violence against women, but we really want to acknowledge that certainly men can be victims of violence as well.
And what about the policymakers now? Are there other directions that they might be taking? Do you think it would be useful for them to pursue this idea that if victims of violence have advocates to help them navigate the system, that would be better than having people on hold on the telephone for hours at a time?
Right. And I might jump in here to address that question. It's Nadine. And I think I want to make a couple points about policy at a broad level. The first one sort of relates to clinical policies. And I think we would want to encourage, especially educators, to take this on as an issue of importance. We did a study in Ontario that looked at what type of primary education, and I mean by this undergraduate and postgraduate education to healthcare providers and social service providers, what are they actually being provided in their training around this issue? And it's not very good. It's quite inconsistent in terms of what's provided, how it's provided, and the intensity of that education. So that's the first thing. If we want clinicians to be able to address this, we really need to do a better job in their initial education, their continuing professional education, and then within the different types of clinical sites to provide support and resources for ongoing training, and even at the level of knowing what's available in that particular community. Do we have protocols and information that clinicians can access and then share with women? So that's sort of at one policy level. I think we've addressed the issue of whether, at a policy level, we should be implementing routine universal screening going forward. Our opinion based on this particular trial, and again, we need replication, is that we should not be continuing on with new universal screening programs. And again, of course, thinking about the system navigation approach, I think it's really key for policymakers at the political level to understand that we need to continue resourcing our services adequately. And I know right now is not a good time for services to be asking for money. I think there's a lot of concern that a lot of social services will be being cut in our current economic climate. And, this will exacerbate the problem. We know that things like unemployment and underemployment are strongly related to exposure and perpetration of violence. So it can become a vicious cycle quite quickly. So I guess at a policy level, we should make sure not to start cutting programs because it's easy to do, because we'll end up exacerbating the problem.
It seems like there's a lot of work to be done yet.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. McMillan, Dr. Wathen, thank you so much for your time today. And I will put on our website some resources that you will provide that our readers can use to get more information about this issue.
Great. Thank you very much, Joe.
Great. And I do think, Joe, I think it's an excellent editorial that accompanies our trial.
It certainly guided me as I was trying to understand the work and its implications. And thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, the two of you have a good day and a great weekend.
Yeah, I hope you're feeling better, Joe.
me too. Thank you so much. Finally, you can reach us at 1-617-440-4374. With help or suggestions, or you can write to jelia@nejm.org. If you want to listen to earlier podcasts, they're all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all stories can also be found. We're all ears here. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next week. Enough said.